one of the things I said is you have to create moments that people cannot duplicate if they go back. So that's when you create unique moment, but also that they're not comparing. And you have to have contrast in everything you do.
Family life is essential. Jim and I are on a mission to help you live the best one. You'll hear personal stories from thought leaders of strengths and struggles with proven strategies to help you make the most of your 18 summers. I'm your co-host, Jamie Shields.
Hey, 18 Summers Tribe, Jim and Jamie back. This is a special episode. Our good friend, Mr. Eric Rosenberg, is with us. And Eric has a he's got a couple of things to talk about. The business of meetings, where he is going to talk today about some of the things he does to make things extremely memorable, not only on the business side, but family side, but especially his new book, Before It's Too Late. And this is really where Eric and I connected on a personal level at a business event, me, him, and Jamie. And, you know, we're just excited to hear your story because it's pretty touching and I think it's extremely important. So welcome to 18 Summers.
Thank you for having me.
So good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Same here, really.
Well, I think we want to start by talking about your story. You wrote a book recently, Before It's Too Late, to your daughters. And it's about leaving your home country to come to America, which really stems back to situations of two generations. Mm-hmm. But would you just share with our listeners a little bit about this background and why you wrote the book and the story behind it?
Yes. And how you have three daughters, and I would just love to know the context of their age and whom you wrote this book to as you wrote it.
Right. So I wrote the book for the three of them. And the reason is 10 years ago, we moved to the US from Belgium. It took me about 10 years to convince my wife. And then when she was aligned, then we made it happen. It's basically the book is for them and their children and their children's children and the next generations. That's the first and foremost target, if you want, why I wrote the book. Because I wanted them to understand why we took them out of seeing their four grandparents every week, out of a small Shabbat dinner being 20 people, out of a Passover dinner in our house being 45 people seated, and just then the five of us here in South Florida when we arrived. I wanted them to understand what happened in Europe the last 40 years, the rise of anti-Semitism, again, the fact that they haven't learned anything from what happened in World War II. And also, I wanted them to understand how a generation or a group of people from politician, media, so-called leaders can, again, target appeasement or use appeasement as their way of leading, which, as we all know, never brings anything good. And at the end of the day, it's always the same. Lead, follow, or get out of the way. And yeah. So I wanted to write this book for them and the next generation in my family. And I decided to publish it because of all the people I was talking to, friends, families, or people that were just acquaintances. And I was telling them about the book and why we left, the rise of anti-Semitism in Belgium and in Europe. And they said, really? No, don't you think that? Well, and I was tired of explaining. And so I thought, you know what? I understand that they don't know. And if they want to know, here is the book. So there's about 300 pages and there's 175 links to other reference, blog, posts, videos, books that if people want to check, they could check. And that's really a legacy project. So that's who I wrote the book for and why I wrote the book.
Yeah. And a lot of the inspiration from the book, I mean, it's for your daughters, but it's also from your family surviving the Holocaust, correct?
Correct. So I wanted them also to understand the family history and the fact that things happen and you need to not put your head in the sand and then thinking that it's not going to happen again, even if it's not happening, never happening exactly the same, but the roots are similar. So my grandparents came from Poland, Russia, Romania to Belgium. My grandfather on my father's side was a blue collar in our hometown, Charleroi. And joined the armed partisan, the resistance, at the beginning of the war. And my grandfather on my mother's side came to study in Liège, engineer, which was one of the top three engineering school at that time, and worked for the ASEC, a large corporation there in Charleroi all his life. And he was actually arrested by the Nazi, and he jumped out of a train that would have taken him to Auschwitz on November.
I remember that story. You wrote about that.
Yes. And so
he was on his way to Auschwitz and he jumped off the train.
Right. So he was with friends in the train. They didn't know they were going to Auschwitz, but they were told they were going to work. And they said, listen, look, we have nothing here. We're not going to work. It's absolutely wrong. And it was still the time where they were not using those wagons for animals that they were using afterwards. So there was a lot of wooden plank blocking the doors and everything. So they start releasing those one or two planks. And in the middle of the night, when the train was turning, so going a little less fast, they jumped. And the Nazi shot at them, but thank God it didn't reach my grandfather and his friends, and he hid the rest of the war. And so my parents were hidden children. My mom, who was born in 41, was put in a family outside of Brussels. And my father, who's was born in 36, was hidden in a farm in Tien at the Jouan family and the rest of the war. And so I wanted my kids to know about that, because I believe that we need to transmit history. We need to learn from history, and you need to know your roots. You know, my wife and I always looking at our kids. We want to give them roots and wings, but that's also part of their roots. And so last summer, my wife and I took our three kids back to Belgium, and we went to Tien. We went with the Jouan family, and we were at the exact point where my father in 1944 was bringing the cows back to the farm, and the motorcade of tanks from the Nazi were going for the Battle of the Bulge. And the cows were blocking the road. And so the leader of the tanks pointed a gun at my dad, say, rouse, move the cows. And thank God another one put the hand of the guy down. But my father never forgot that moment. And so it was very emotional to be at the very exact spot where that happened. Yeah.
Wow.
And how do your daughters embrace this? Like you said, to them, maybe it felt as though they had a wonderful community. They had a house full of people that loved them. They had camaraderie. They had grandparents and lineage. And how did you communicate them at the time of leaving? I mean, this is a huge transition. And so much of what I teach as for simplicity of what we tell our children, just as much as they need to know without overwhelming them, you have to convey a huge message to them without maybe scaring them. I'm not sure. How was that?
It's a very good question. And I guess, you know, we try to do it as best as we can. And I'm sure we're making mistakes like every parents, but it was not only hard on them, it was also hard on my wife. And the way I look at life is always sometimes too harsh, but we arrive here and I told them, I don't want to hear it's better or it's worse. I don't want any comparison. It is what it is, and it's moving forward. We're not coming back. So that was in terms of the mindset.
Was there a series of events, or was there a catalyst?
There is a full series of events. There is not one in particular. But let me just finish to answer Jamie's question, because I think it's important. And your question is also very important.
Yeah, please do.
With my ADD, I don't want to go in a direction. So when we moved here, trying to tell the kids, we didn't want to not tell them the truth. And to your point, Jamie, we want to protect them, not exaggerating, but still. So the little one said, you know, it's bad people over there, and then for your future. But then she would say, but if they're bad people, why are grandparents still there? Yeah. So it's not easy. But also the fact that people were asking us, oh, it must be difficult. And I would say, well, yes, but we're not arriving at Ellis Island with three kids and two suitcases, not knowing where we're going to sleep at night, which is true as well. But my wife, one day, said, stop saying that. It's hard enough. Her family is a tribe. And as I say, we were seeing everyone every week. So it is not easy. It is hard. They were crying every Friday night because, you know, at the beginning, it's just the five of us. And that's where you have to come back to why you're doing what you're doing and keep explaining, but also be very focused on the purpose and the reason why you're taking those decisions. And this could not have happened if my wife and I were not aligned on the reason why. So that's trying to quickly answer your question, Jim. And to your point, Jim, about the series of events, there's been so many things. There's so many stories. When I decided to write a book, I had a mind map. And before speaking with the two editors, one is Jewish, one is not Jewish, on purpose. Before speaking with them, I said, okay, I have to list the stories I want to tell. And I opened an Excel sheet, and in less than 2 hours, I had over 100 stories that I wanted to tell. From my childhood, how I discovered antisemitism, from the politician, especially the Socialist Party in Belgium, that wanted to have the vote and would do anything to please the Islamist. I wanted also to explain the difference between Muslim and Islamist, because if you don't understand that difference, you're very mistaken and you don't understand the issues at stake in the world. And there were so many stories about what happened, different acts of antisemitism, people that were killed, old people that were killed in Paris, and the story of Mireille Knoll afterwards, actually, after we left, but she was beaten by a neighbor who screamed Allahu Akbar. So the police and the neighbor were afraid and stay in the staircase. And for 20 minutes, she was beaten by this neighbor that she knew since he was a child. And he broke all her bones. And then when the SWAT team arrived, he threw her to the window. She died. And it took months for the French so-called justice to acknowledge that this was an antisemitic act. And 2 years later, during the trial, the jury said that he cannot be tried because the guy had smoked too much cannabis and was not conscious of what he was doing. Yeah, I mean, it seems insane, but that happened. So there were so many different stories. I think the tipping point for my wife, after all that happened, the killing, the Jewish school in Auxerre-Thorens in Toulouse, and so many different other things, the tipping point for her was the 11th of January, 2009, where for the first time, Israel finally decided to defend itself against the terrorists of the Hamas in Gaza that were firing missiles at Israel and finally decided to get in. And there were demonstrations in all the main capital in Europe. And in Brussels, there were 50,000 people, 50,000 Muslim, Islamist, that were chanting, "Dead to Israel, no, the Israel Nazi, dead to the Jews." And in the first line of that demonstration were every single political party represented.
Wow.
And so they pretended they didn't see the poster behind them, they didn't hear the chant, whatever. But when they saw the images, nobody said anything. And then my wife thought, if even our elected officials are not able to speak up against those lies and are doing anything to remain in power, that's it, game over. And if you think about it, I always ask people, how many Jews you think there are in the world? I'm not going to put you on the spot now, but I hear answers from 100 million to a billion. There are in total 16 million Jews in the world.
Wow, I thought it would have been a lot more.
And so in the US, it's 2.4% of the population. And so we never counted much in terms of voting. And yet you see all the discoveries and what has been done for humanity in general. But at the end of the day, my wife was aligned. And so there was not one specific event, but a whole series of events. And we projected ourselves in the future and said, listen, if we didn't have children, maybe we can finish our professional life and then travel a little bit. But we have three young daughters. They don't have any future there. So it's time to leave.
Now, Eric, I know that you say America is the greatest country on earth, right? This is
what Yes.
And now you've been here for 10 years, which has been quite an interesting 10 years here.
Right.
And I wonder, are there any things that you see that are concerning to you here, what you've seen, where you came from? Because so often when we speak to people who have come here for safety and for all of the opportunities that America provides, sometimes they see these little ruffles that they like to warn others over. Well, gosh, in my home country, this started as here and it grew to here. Is there anything you see or feel that concerns you that your daughters are in the right place, but they need to be aware?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I still believe 10 years later that America is indeed the greatest country on earth. Now, you know, I had those tough conversation with my elder one who was in the school when the shooting at Stoneman Douglas happened in Parkland.
Wow.
And so the next day we seated in the living room and she looked at me and she said, "Dad, if anything would have happened to me, would you still say that it's safer for us here than in Belgium?"
Wow.
Tough question. And I look at her and I said, listen, first of all, we're very lucky that you were not one of the 17 victims out of 17 people wounded. And your mother and I are absolutely convinced that for Jews, it is safer in America than it is anywhere else, especially in Belgium or France. But we don't have 100% safe place in the world. It doesn't exist. So that was the first part of my answer to your question. The second part, I'm very concerned when it comes specifically to antisemitism, and I will speak larger in a minute, but when it comes to antisemitism, I'm very concerned to see people that are aligning again the alliance between the extreme left and the Islamist, or people that are, you know, the neo-Nazis. So you have those two extreme, and I see the political divide even between Jewish people. And I always tell, if you have cancer and AIDS and you cure one, you're still going to die from the other.
There you go.
And if you are a secular Jew or a very religious Jew or a Democrat Jew or a Republican Jew, at the end of the day, for those people, you still remain a Jew and they're going to come at you. So you better stop this dividing. But some of the politicians that are accepting language, somebody like Ilhan Omar, it's absolutely disgusting and racist what she's saying. But, you know, she's got votes, so we're not going to be too loud against her. And it's the same on both sides of the aisle. So that I see is this complacency or this focus on not speaking too loud because they're bringing votes and you want to remain in power. And at the end of the day, those people don't care about human principles or integrity. They just want the power. The third point, which is even more important, whatever starts with the Jews never ends with the Jews. And if you look at any country in the world, when Jews had to leave, what it meant for democracy afterwards, what it meant for the countries afterwards, it was a disaster. And so when I see those DEI programs that are not including the Jews, I'm thinking, really? What else do you need to qualify for a minority when you have 2.4% of the population? And to your question, Jamie, what I cannot stand and never was able to stand and will never be able to stand is the political correctness and people that are not listening to what you say, but they are just trying to transform you or guilt you to promote their agenda. I give you some example. If I say, why is the most of the DEI program in the universities in America not including the Jews? Some people will say, don't you think that diversity matters? Of course, I think that diversity matters. That has nothing to do with it. If I say that the leadership of the BLM, the Black Lives Matter organization, the leadership of the Black Lives Matter organization is a bunch of Marxists, anti-Semites that are supporting BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanction, which is an organization who wants to wipe out Israel out of the map and kill the Jews. And when I say that, I don't know why you should support an organization that is supporting another organization who wants to kill my people. Explain to me how does that work. But if I say that the leadership of Black Lives Matter is a bunch of racists, some people will ask me, don't you think that Black Lives Matter? Of course, I do think that Black Lives Matter. I never say that. So is this using political correctness to promote their agenda without even listening to what you're saying and coming to you said, we need to be able to have difficult conversation until you actually start having difficult conversation, then they want to cancel you, they don't want to listen to you.
Yes. Yeah, that's been the scariest thing.
It's a great example.
The lack of, yeah.
I don't know, I guess I'm just kind of noodling on that for a minute. I'm like, wow, it's so important because just even that indirect support is important. What are you saying by what you're not saying, I guess?
Well, what I've learned too is this, you brought it up, the fringe politics has become very interesting, especially in the last 10 years. Just because you yell the loudest doesn't mean you're right. And that can be far right or the far left, but it's been particularly ugly the last few years. And I say, it's really a shame to watch leaders pull to the out fringes to please someone that's just being loud. And that's depressing. That has been depressing for us. And that's something, the conversation we try to have with our children of saying, this is something you have to watch just because someone's yelling the loudest. You know, what is the real communication? What is really going on under the surface? What is the real mission? And these are things, unfortunately, we are no fans of mainstream media, as I'm sure you know. know what's going on.
Same here. Same here.
So how do we educate our children? Because we're definitely not going to lean on mainstream media. So how do you do that? How do you help them decipher and be free thinking to not get caught up in these kind of things?
Yeah. So you were also a guest on my podcast when we talk about 18 summers and speaking with our kids. Every night we have a dinner. What are the three good things of the day? And if there's something that's happening in politics or in the world, I bring into the table and I provide questions and also my point of view. And I never tell my kids, this is what you need to think. And I'm telling them, this is my point of view. And these are the reasons why I'm thinking that. So to raise them, I want to raise three strong women that are able to think by themselves and that can have a critical thinking, which, by the way, is the primary goal of universities today, which is completely lost. So I'm bringing a situation, or I'm showing them documentary that might be controversial, but I want them to see it and to discuss it. And we were watching one of the controversial documentary topic no later than last week. And my little one, who's now 13, so she's bat mitzvah, she can think by herself. Mm-hmm. And she asked me about somebody who's being interviewed. Do you like that person, Dad? And I said, listen first to what they're saying. Then when the person finished answering, I paused and said, it doesn't matter if I like that person or not. It first matter what you think about what that person said. Now, I'm going to tell you what I think and why I think that, but it's important that you don't agree with me necessarily, but you think by yourself. And that's how I'm trying to raise them. I'm totally with you with the mainstream media, which has become now more a political vehicle, whatever you're looking at one or the other.
Agenda, really. It's an agenda totally. That's sponsored. So
totally. You know, that's one of the story I tell in the book. We had a lunch with the Belgian Management and Marketing Association, and now I seated next to the general manager of Le Soir, which is like the New York Times in Belgium, with actually the same ideology and the same pro-Palestinian lie propaganda. Mm-hmm. And he was speaking about his newspaper. And then I said, you know what? The way you talk about your newspaper, you made me want to buy the newspaper again. So you can imagine there was a big silence on the table. And I said, when I was a kid, my grandfather would put Le Soir in my hands and he would say, read. You're going to read different opinion. You're going to read different articles that are totally opposed to each other and you will make your own opinion.
But smart.
Today you don't have that.
No.
And I told him, by the way you're treating the Middle East with a specific journalist, I didn't give the name of the journalist, but with a specific journalist is absolutely disgusting. And he answered in front of everyone, you are absolutely right. And that person is not in charge of the Middle East anymore. And 6 months later, the so-called journalist was back in charge. So you see as well there what's going on behind the curtain with the pressure of journalists and what the management would just close their eyes because obviously they're looking just at numbers. So it's important for me to share with my kids what I think. And as equally important, I want them to think by themselves. I want them to be critical of what they're hearing. And going back to your previous question, I think that's a big danger in most of the universities and colleges in America. You're not allowed to have your own opinion anymore. And if you want to invite people that are not fitting in the dogma of the university, then people will even interrupt them. So much for the freedom of speech. And that is not acceptable. And then you're creating a society that is basically a society of sheeps that are divided in two groups and then just leading the...
Without critical thinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, Eric, as you guys have made this massive transition 10 years ago, what are some things? I mean, the other book that you wrote was on memorable and breathtaking experiences. So you know right. A little bit of something about holding a container for experiences.
Yeah.
What have you done with your wife and your daughters as a family to hold this space as you make this transition? Because, man, there's a lot of intention that has to go in what you've done.
Yes.
Kind of combining your two worlds, I'm excited to hear how you've brought your first ideas now into this family transition.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great question. First of all, we have a Shabbat dinner every Friday night together.
Explain what that is so people who aren't familiar.
So in the Jewish faith, the Shabbos, it starts when there's the first star in the sky on Friday night and until Saturday night when there's the first star in the sky. And for very traditional and religious people, you just don't do anything, you don't work. We're not that religious, but we like to do the dinner together. We like to do the prayer, and we like the candles, and there's a lot of symbolic there. And it's a moment where you stop everything you do and you're together. That doesn't mean that we're not going to see friends, but if friends want to see us, invite us, or they want to come to the house, they know it's with the children because it's Friday night.
Yeah, love it.
And so obviously we were alone for the first weeks, and we were very lucky to have a family that welcome us and allow us to do the high holidays that were just coming with them so that we were not alone. But it's really trying to be together on that Friday night, trying to be available for the kids, explaining, asking questions, giving them the support that's needed when it's needed. And then creating moment together. So, you know, again, coming back to what you're saying, I love the 18 summer concept. We try to do holidays that are absolutely unique. Also that they would think, huh, it's worth to go on holidays with mom and dad because we're doing cool things. But it's really plus leveraging all the network I've built throughout the years so that we can have access to things that we would not have access necessarily. So we took them, for instance, one of the things I said is you have to create moments that people cannot duplicate if they go back. So that's when you create unique moment, but also that they're not comparing and you have to have contrast in everything you do. So 1 year we took them to India, which is an absolutely stunning, fabulous country that I love, and the people are wonderful. And we did the classical triangle, Delhi, Agra, Jaipur, and then went a little bit Udaipur and Delwara, renew our vows. And I did the honeymoon there years ago. I did so many incentive trips when I was in Belgium with my corporate events agency. We would go to India. It was just phenomenal. And so they were going from one palace to the other. And thanks to our partner there, we had a lunch in the private dining room of the Maharaja of Jaipur on the Lalik table. I mean, things that completely insane and beautiful. And then the next year, we did an RV trip in the west of the country and in the US. So I rented the Class A. And for 3 weeks, we slept in the RV all the time. And it's totally contrast. It's absolutely different. One is extremely luxury and one is, you know, it's our RV life, which is great. My little one asked me to do it another one with her. So she and I are going on an RV trip in Maine this summer.
Oh, nice.
It's really, and by the way, you help us as well because you know a thing or two about RV camp.
Yeah.
So it's really creating moments that we are together, that we are living moments that we cannot do if we're not going together, and creating surprise for them. One of my daughters wants to know everything in advance and doesn't like to be surprised. And now even her, she said, no, okay, I don't want to know what we're going to be doing. So it's those moments that you create together. And plus, we try to be at all their sports game. We do Krav Maga together every week.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. So we try to apply everything you're teaching. We try to apply it to our family.
And everyone's transitioned well? And your wife is all...
Oh, yeah. Everyone's transitioned well. So the girls, the eldest one was 10. So it was difficult, but it was okay. The middle one, she's a real old soul. So that it was the toughest for her. She was 7. It was really difficult for her. And now the three of them are thriving. And the third one was 3. So... she's the little American of the family. If I say the F word, she's going to say, Dad. I say, what? And I repeat, F, F, F. She's really raised like, you know, we raised them, the three of them the same way, but she's really the more American of us all. But they've transitioned very well. None of them could speak English.
Wow.
And you wouldn't hear an accent. I mean, the eldest one, when she finished high school, so she moved here when she started middle school. And when she finished high school, she was in the top 1% in Stoneman Douglas. And I told her, you know, you're just like your dad. I was also in the top 1%. The only thing is that you had to start counting from the bottom. So they transitioned very well. I'm very proud of them. And my wife was very difficult for her. She was a lawyer. She's an amazing lawyer, an amazing litigator, trust me. And she was managing her father's firm. So it was a huge transition for her. And then when we moved, the first year, she didn't stop. She was taking care of the new house being built. She was helping us get integrated. I was traveling and getting any job that I could get in consultancy. And she was with the kids, helping them with school and everything and learning how the system works here. Nevertheless, interestingly, she would say, when somebody asked her, what do you do? And she would say nothing. And say, how could you say you're doing nothing? We could not do this if you were not taking care of all of that. It's a teamwork.
Yeah.
And so after a year, she decided to start a new career. She said, everybody wants to have a second life. I'm having mine. And she's now an extremely successful realtor. She's working on luxury real estate and all the things that I could not do. So you need a lot of patience and you need to really be a good negotiator, that she is. So I would say 10 years later, we all become American. I'm very proud of it. And we have rebuilt a social network, rebuilt life here. And we never regretted once the decision we took, even if it was not always easy and sometimes not always easy, but we never regretted once.
It's very brave of all of you.
Yeah. So what for like kind of a send-off? There's a family out there, they're wanting to make a big change. Maybe it's not from Brussels to Florida, but it's from New York to Florida. It's from two states over, two counties over, might seem, but you know, and it seems vast and huge. What advice would you give to that family when you're putting so much on the line? You're going to feel separated, but you know, I mean, I had this same thing of different. I knew I had to leave where I grew up in the Northeast. It was so clear to me on every bit of my intuition, like you felt. And lucky I did that. And that's how I found Jamie. But I didn't do it with a family. So I
kept trying to hide.
Didn't work. Didn't work.
We didn't have to talk about it publicly.
Well, with you had the family. So that's at a different level. What would you say? There's so many families out there thinking about transitioning into something else, to somewhere else. Like, what advice would you give them since you had to take such deep waters to do so? What advice would you give?
That's a great question. I would say three things. The first one, you really need to be clear on why you're doing it. What are the reasons? What is the purpose? Whether you have kids or not, whether you're moving from a different country or not, why are you making that change? That's the first thing. The second thing, in our case, it could not have happened if my wife and I were not aligned. The first time I told her one day we'll have to leave this country is the night of Yom Kippur in 2002. I was a volunteer for the security of the Jewish community. So I spoke a lot with the cops and I came home and I said, this is what they told me. This is what's happening. One day we'll have to leave this country. And it took her 10 years to be aligned. But if we're not aligned, we cannot do it. And the third thing is to take action. It's fascinating to me how human beings in general will choose misery over uncertainty. Wow. And so when you have this conviction, whether you're right or wrong, doesn't matter. It's what you believe. If you have a belief, if you come to a conclusion and you're not taking action on it, I think that's very sad.
Wow.
There's that conflict within your soul, right? If you know what you're supposed to do and then you don't.
Don't choose misery over inaction.
Yes.
Or they will choose misery over inaction.
A lot of the people and a lot of our friends would say, are you exaggerating? It's not that bad. Now, nobody's saying that. That is not that bad. And a lot of them actually left already. Wow. So it's, and I'm not saying this. My point is, you need to be convinced what you're doing. And as much as I always respect what people do, is their decision. I'm not going to make a different decision because of what others are thinking or saying if I'm convinced that that's the best thing I should be doing for my family.
And that is about as honorable as you can get, in my values and opinion. So
thank you.
Eric, where can people learn more about your book, what you do? Where can our listeners?
Thank you. So the book is called Before It's Too Late, A Love Letter to My Daughters in America. It's on Amazon. And I guess the best way to reach me is on LinkedIn. So it's Eric, E-R-I-C, Rosenberg, R-O-Z-E-N-B-E-R-G. And that's where you can connect with me the easiest.
And we'll definitely put your info in our...
Yes, it'll be in the show notes. Well, my friend, it's always an honor and a pleasure hearing from such a diverse background and story and such a love for family. So we appreciate you. We look forward to more conversations, and I'm up for a visit. We're only 5 hours away. So
exactly.
Yeah, so you let us know and we'd love to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining the 18 Summers podcast and putting your family in priority position. Subscribe and leave a review and help other families just like you.